Hello, and welcome back to Millennial 2018. And I'm now here with Europe is Falling. That is the name of his channel, which he started, I don't know when it was, about 9 months ago, I think. I think I first became aware of it about 6 to 9 months ago, but you can explain that to us. Europe is Falling, welcome to Millennial. And please talk about your channel for a few minutes.
Thank you, Colin. Yeah, I think maybe my channel's about six months old. You were actually my very first subscriber, which was a nice welcome to YouTube. My name's EIF, or Europe is Falling. My YouTube channel is a mixture of entertainment and serious ideas, I guess you'd say, current events and long-term consequences. I've spoken about things like mass immigration, demographics, a bit of race, realism, all the fun stuff, basically. I also covered a little bit about how to deal with ideological change and personal difficulty that can stem from leaving the Overton window. Thank you for having me on.
Oh, yeah, you're welcome. So how did you arrive? Give us some background about not necessarily your life or whatever, nothing doxable, but how did you arrive at this place where you wanted to create a YouTube channel? No, well, first of all, let's go for the politics first, and then we can talk about it.
How did I move politically, and where did I come from? Is that what you mean?
Yeah.
I was years ago at university and had a few Marxist professors who filled my head with all that stuff. So I kind of became, I wasn't massively political at university, but I would have considered myself far left, pretty much like a Corbynite or a communist, I guess you'd say, at least in that direction. A little bit like Chris Dangerfield, my journey similar to his. And then getting more on the internet after I left university, spent about 10, 15 years gradually making this plod towards the center and then further right. And then really in the last couple of years, moved towards much more towards the alt-right and the more difficult topics that are kind of unique to the alt-right, I guess you'd say.
And what would you say those topics are? Because that's an interesting thing to say right off the bat, actually. What is unique about the alt-right?
Well, I think that people I'm interested in on the internet, you could call them alt-right or new right, but they talk about things like race realism. They link it to evolution and this type of thing. And these difficult types of ideas that are, you know, you wouldn't talk about them as a UKIP member or somebody, you know, who's seen as quote unquote far right by the mainstream, I guess you'd say. But I guess the main thing is demographic change and race. Those two things, I think, really separate the alt-right from, you know, people like your Sargons and Count Dankulas and these kinds of guys.
Oh, for sure. Obviously, within the sphere of YouTube, that modern social media, that's true. I thought you meant that the alt-right was unique in terms of a departure from nationalism prior to it. What would you say to that?
I'm not sure I understand your question.
Well, how is the alt-right a new thing, or you know, was it a new? How was it a new thing when it started, like 3-4 years ago?
Well, I guess in my mind it was new in the sense that I hadn't really heard any real discussion about demographics before. I hadn't really heard any real discussion about racial difference before. My whole life had been, we're all equal, we're all the same. That's really the drum I'd heard my whole life. And so I guess I would say in that sense, it's new. But I guess there probably has been many people before this short period of time on the internet who've been dealing with these ideas. You probably know more about that than myself, in all honesty.
Oh, yeah. I mean, what I would say is that you see, it's funny talking about this because I don't know to what extent people are abandoning the alt-right label or the sort of collective that was known by that label. But it seems that quite a few people have used that term voluntarily without me saying anything. So it does seem like it still has currency and relevance to people. And anyway, that aside, I think what was new about the alt-right was the, first of all, the methods, you know, 8chan, 4chan, the memes, for sure. That was obviously a new thing. A certain attitude, a certain irreverence that was necessary, definitely necessary, to break free of the shackles of, you know, the guilt tripping and so on that has been imposed upon nationalists for decades. And then another part of it would be the optimism, which sort of goes with that irreverence. Same thing, an optimistic attitude. And then the other part of it is that it wasn't just nationalism, and certainly in the first place. I think it became that more recently. But I think in the first place, 2015, as I've said before, 2015, 2014, the alt-right was really a sort of open-minded, right-wing appraisal of post-modernity. And that was why it appealed to me so much. It wasn't just, because if it was just white nationalism, then you would just call it that. But it wasn't. It was something more broad than that. And I think that that's, I've said before on my AMAs, I think that's what we need to move back to. As you know, whether we use that name or not, whether we use that label or not, I think that is what we need to be moving back to, because it was far more productive than the stuff that we did in 2017. I think that's basically a consensus at this point.
Yeah, I mean, there's also this idea of how technology enabled this kind of alternative movement to kind of begin, because it's basically dependent on the internet, all of this stuff, in a lot of ways. I often think about how really I would never have discovered any of this information if it wasn't for the internet, which is quite an interesting thing, because it's almost like this unique kind of moment in time where we had a lot of freedom. It was kind of in the Wild West era of the internet, at least more so than today, and people were basically speaking freely, and you had the opportunity to connect with them and find them. Over a lifetime in the past, you might have happened to come across people with certain ideas, but it would have taken you typically a lot longer, or you more than likely wouldn't have even come across these ideas. It's almost as if the internet's kind of sped up the ability for people to connect with new ideas to the point where ideological change is now something that can happen very, very quickly in an individual, because they don't have to rely on traveling all around the world and meeting, you know, people from all different places around the world. They can just do that in their home really quick. I think that plays a big part in all of this.
Oh, it absolutely does. I mean, that was a huge part. I mean, you know, like right now, you know, you and I have never met. We're in different countries, and yet here we are doing a collaboration, a hangout, and it will be getting watched by it is being watched by hundreds of people, and they're probably in lots of different countries. So there's clearly a lot to be said for this, that what technology makes possible. And I think that, I mean, the whole meme thing is obviously a product of internet culture. It could only exist on the internet, really. And yeah, so it's very unprecedented, really. And I think that the thing is that cultural movements used to sort of emerge from intellectuals being in the same physical location together. But nowadays, clearly, there's this sort of stage zero that's possible with this, where it happens on the internet first. It's sort of birthed on the internet.
Yeah, and it's like you say, I mean, it's kind of new territory. I think that's one of the reasons why the mainstream is starting to get, it was all fun and games basically back in the day. You know, it was all like, you know, let's have free speech on the internet, and that's very important. Even a few years ago, Twitter was waving that flag. And I think post-Brexit, post-Trump, post kind of, you know, other nationalist rises throughout Europe and things, they're starting to really notice that you know, they're starting to roll back all of that stuff that they were talking about, I guess you'd say. They're starting to see it's going to have real consequences, this technology, probably more so than anyone really anticipated.
Oh yeah, they've realized that some people say things that they don't like, basically. And if Jack Dorsey gives people the freedom to say whatever they want, then some of them are going to have politics that are diametrically opposed to him, his politics. And they're going to say stuff that he finds troubling and inconvenient. So, you know, I mean, I think that he actually, I mean, I don't want to zero in on Jack Dorsey, but you know, the point is that the SJWs or the left or the progressives, whatever you want to call them, realized that, they, I mean, whether accidentally or not, and with some of them it will have been accidental, they were found themselves in a position where they could censor their political opponents. And some of them will have gone into, you know, a job in Silicon Valley so that they could do that. Others will simply have been carried away with the culture of that, you know, well, that looks like my kind of place, and whatever. The point is that the end result is that this is what we're up against now. You know, we're up against social media corporations that are infested with SJWs who hate us, hate our ideas, and think nothing of shutting down our channels and our income streams, as we saw with Sargon just the other day. Sargon himself was banned from Patreon. But then you get also the really serious things like Alex Jones and Gavin McInnes. Now, you and I clearly have disagreements with all three of these men, but I think you would agree with me that what's been done to these people is pretty awful.
Yeah. Especially Sargon, in all honesty, and I've made a few videos critical of him, but it's pretty sketchy when people in the center are being having their income taken away like this. Like, I'm laughing at it because it's so ridiculous. Because, you know, I mean, there's just nothing controversial about him in my mind. So I just that makes it frightening, because then I think, you know, people like me, where they might, you know, who knows what they want to do to me, in all honesty.
Well, you know, I think that normal people wouldn't. I think normal people would agree that Sargon is not controversial. Like, ordinary, the man in the Clapham omnibus would not be outraged by anything that Sargon has ever said, actually. But also, quite frankly, the man in the Clapham omnibus would not be outraged by anything that you and I have said at least 20 years ago. Maybe nowadays he would be. But I really don't think that even our ideas are that shocking or controversial. It's just the people who find them controversial and the people who find Sargon, his stuff, controversial, are leftist fanatics. They're, you know, progressive Daleks. That's it.
What we're finding is that it doesn't matter how far right you are, in all honesty. If you're not on the hype train of progressivism, basically you're the enemy. And when you were talking to Sargon, you were talking about you know, these kind of these disagreements that we're getting in the right, and saying that we kind of need to unite. And in that respect, I totally agree with you. And I was kind of just got this sense that ultimately it's going to come down to kind of progressive globalist utopians versus the rest of us. And you know, everything else is going to fall by the wayside at some point. So broadly speaking, in that sense, yeah, it's kind of scary times, in all honesty.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you've had your own troubles with censorship on YouTube. I know that you've had a few videos put into limited state, and so have I. It is definitely rising. I remember when limited state first appeared, I think it was about this time last year, I think. I mean, we could go into that. This is something I wish I'd talked about in my speech about censorship in Erkenbrand, the machinery of silence speech. I wish I'd talked about limited state, because I think limited state, there's stuff to say about that, you know, on its own. It is a sinister thing on its own, that the video is shorn off its comments, its upvotes, its downvotes, all related videos. This video is not related to anything. It's just entirely adrift on its own, with absolutely nothing to link it to the rest of the world, except for the channel name. That's the one thing that you can, it links, there's a link to the channel. But that's it. Other than that, it just is completely on its own. And I find that bizarre, but also completely out of keeping with everything else that goes on YouTube. You know, yeah, it's like this is the thing. This is a thing that we keep in the attic. We're completely ashamed of it. We don't like people seeing it at all. But since you've asked, well, here it is. You know, that's the sort of attitude. It's really like they're showing you something, it's showing you something awful, dirty, dangerous, and disgusting. That's how limited state feels. But there's also the Kafkaesque silencing of it as well. That you can watch the video, but you can't comment on it. because that kills, more practically speaking, that kills the community building. But also it's just in and of itself sinister because, well, there's to be no discussion about this. You cannot talk about this video. That is fucked up.
Then there's no one to contact at these companies. And I mean, it's a little bit like when you get like temporarily banned on Twitter, you have to go in and actually delete your own tweet. It's like, you know, that you're having to learn. They're trying to re-educate you. It's laughable, honestly. I've even seen Jack Dorsey talk about that. And he talks about, you know, helping people to learn the right types of algorithm. You can just imagine.
Just the fuck right off. Fuck off, Jack.
You can imagine all this bollocks going around in the board, you know, sat around in the boardroom at Twitter talking about how they're going to help these, you know, these uneducated masses conform to diversity. It's a nightmare. Yeah, it is very Orwellian, and it's scary because it's the internet, all of this stuff that really wouldn't fly in the real world, or at least there's been certain boundaries that have now been crossed, like that wouldn't have been crossed in the real world. You know, like, you know, things like you wouldn't expect a bank to ring up Sargon and say, oh, we can't use you anymore, for example. You can't use our service anymore. Like, and that's the equivalent in the real world. Yet for some reason, that's okay online. So yeah, it's
if that did happen, there would be a human being that you could talk to about it. Whereas with Twitter and YouTube, there's just nothing. I mean, there's the automated appeals process, but I think that's automated to the extent that it's a robot that reads your appeal. I don't really know. I mean, I don't know if a human being ever intervenes in this process. I remember when I got banned from Twitter, and I'm not going to go on about it, but I did 5 appeals because I thought maybe the first one, yeah, eventually it will get to someone who's sympathetic. But didn't matter what I said. I think after the first thing, they still let you lodge appeals, but I don't think anyone actually reads them.
Computer says no. Yeah, it's grim.
Exactly. Yeah. I hadn't thought of that. Yeah, it's a very strange age that we live in. I remember trying to explain to a boomer, let's say, and I don't mean that disparagingly, but I was trying to explain that, no, there isn't a number that I can call at YouTube to talk to a customer services person. They're dealing with, this is a massive global corporation that deal with God knows how many complaints every single day. There is no human being. There is no switchboard. There is no call center. There's no, can I speak to your manager? There's nothing. You're fucked. But, you know, it's funny because, as you say, corporations that are not wholly online do have such departments. They do have, I mean, God knows how much it must cost to run them. With YouTube, the number of customers is obviously massive. But, you know, if it weren't a website, if it were an actual physical company that operated all over the world, they would still probably have a department where you could talk to a human being. But I know with these social media corporations, I think for some reason it's assumed that they don't need to have a human being that you can actually talk to. It's assumed that the automated thing is enough. I don't know why.
I think they have practical limits just in terms of numbers. Unfortunately, they're just too big. But there's certainly... It is a total nightmare trying to deal with robots.
Yes, it is indeed. So, okay, let's talk more about, well, the concerns that you wanted to talk about. So you want to talk about the difficulty of remaining, of staving off the black pill. So let's talk about that, because you've made several videos about this. I remember what was one of them called Mental Health and the Alt-Right. I can't remember I've done one like that.
And more recently, I've done a few where I've kind of been pretty doomy in what I've been saying. So, it's been, I felt this conflict as I started making videos between optimism and hope for this kind of evolution of society towards a better place, and realizing like that maybe we're going to have to face some kind of revolution event, and talking about like what that would entail, or thinking about, sorry, what that would entail, and with just kind of dwelling on which is going to be the most likely type of outcome to all this. I've been making a few videos about that. And you asking about mental health, how that relates to mental health and blackpilling, I guess.
Yes.
Yeah. So one of the hard things, and some people have called that the final blackpill, is that is this idea that there's not going to be any evolution towards what we want, that essentially there's going to have to be some kind of collapse event. And then we're going to have to start figuring out what to do once we start rebuilding. So I guess dealing with that is a real thing. I did a video recently a little bit about this, because there was a film many years ago. I can't remember the guy who made it, but it's in one of my most more recent videos, called Collapse. It was about like 2012, I think, from memory. But I think his guy's name's Michael Rupert, or Rupert. I can't remember, but it was covering his stuff, and that's very blackpilled, and it was all about basically like peak oil and the ideas of my sense in that video was trying to combine the loss of easily accessible oil, or at least not the loss of it, but the inability to produce more and kind of carry on with this infinite growth paradigm, kind of trying to at least reconcile those ideas in that film with some of the stuff the alt-right talk about, and feeling like that there's this kind of sense of a lot of different problems coming together right now in the world, and people are starting to sense it, and how this is all going to kind of play out. I think there's quite a few problems going on at the minute that aren't necessarily all being kind of looked at the same time and brought together generally. You know, and I found a little bit of that when I was coming into the alt-right, thinking like, well, what about this stuff I used to watch? Like, how would that kind of combine with these ideas and stuff like that? I'm kind of a bit off topic there, but I'll let you kind of jump in.
No, I think that what you're saying there is simply that you obviously, you could just use the phrase, when you get red-pilled. When you get red-pilled, you reappraise things from your past. And some of them, a lot of them, that it's a cliche that you find you can't enjoy things from your past anymore, because it's like you realise how positive it all is and how corrupt it all is and how poisonous it all is. But other things you think, okay, there maybe is a place for this still in my new worldview, but you've got to sort of rethink it. So, I mean, it's not like this is just a total change and now you're going to be a totally different person. I mean, that's over the top. You know, there's no need for that. And I don't think it would be healthy. Mm-hmm. Indeed, you want to remain fundamentally the same person, just a better version of him. But of course, this does involve reappraising certain things and finding new ways to, like, for example, with me, it's like Terence McKenna. And there are a lot of guys actually in the alt-right who are fans or were fans of Terence McKenna. They went through that phase of, you know, this psychedelics and all that. I don't know if you're familiar with Terence McKenna. One of these, he actually called himself an ethnobotanist, but it has nothing to do with ethno-nationalism.
Yeah, I do actually. Joe Rogan goes on about him a fair amount, doesn't he? Was he not part of the Four Horsemen or like something like that? He used to do these talks with those guys.
Yes, it's Rupert Sheldrake, and I can't remember who the third one was, but it was three guys that used to do that stuff. The Four Horsemen, you mustn't. That's those awful new atheists.
That's Harris and those guys, isn't it?
Yeah.
No, I do know. It's McKenna's the guy who got the did he not get brain cancer or something? Did a lot of mushrooms. So I've got
that's
some
correct. Memory, but... He died of a rare form of brain cancer. I mean, it's really awful. Apparently, they tried these different things. I remember gamma knife surgery, which sounded very sci-fi to me, but none of it worked, and he died very quickly, which is a terrible shame because he was. I mean, he was a lefty. But he was highly intelligent, wonderfully articulate. His books are a joy to read, actually, because his way with words is just, you know, stellar, really. And I often wonder, you know, what would he think about us now? I often wonder what would Orwell think about it? I think Orwell would basically be on our side, because I think he was a nationalist. I think he didn't like the crudity, the crassness of overt nationalism, but I think he was a patriot. I think he loved England, and he just, you know, I think basically he would agree with us. I think he would, especially if he saw the evidence that we've seen about certain about certain, you know, biological facts about humanity. But anyway, that's another point. I'm not trying to, if anyone's watching this who's a, you know, old lefty, I'm not trying to co-opt Orwell. I'm just saying it wouldn't surprise me at all if he did basically agree with us. I mean, I can't think that he would be fine with, you know, Rotherham and mass immigration for some reason. That just doesn't seem very convincing to me. But nonetheless, the point is that I often wonder about how people from our past, like our personal past, like people that we've admired and so on, what they would think of what we've become. You know, some of them would surely just disavow us. They'd say, oh, you know, whether it's somebody you've known in real life or whether it's somebody you've admired, like a writer or whatever, some of them would just disavow and think, you've just become, I don't know what you've become, you've become a monster, how could you listen to me and then somehow go off in this direction? This contravenes everything that I stand for. Some of them would be like that, but I also think that some of them would be sympathetic. If they didn't agree with us, they would still understand, okay, I can see how you've gone in this direction.
Yeah, certainly. And you mentioned this guy, Rupert Sheldrake, is it? He did a TED talk a while ago that was banned, a TEDx talk or something. I remember watching that and thinking, I was very interested, actually. He's one of those guys who is out there ideologically in terms of he's basically in the realm of new ideas. And there's a lot of pushback for that. I did a video, not about him, but I did a video a while ago about this type of basically going into this ideological no man's land, you know, kind of ground that's untrodden and some of the difficulties in that. We were talking a little bit about it earlier. But I always felt like when I came into the alt-right a little bit that there's not really that much discussion about dealing with this sense of ostracization and alienation that can come when you leave the Overton window so drastically as many of us have. It's a difficult thing to deal with. I think people, you know, in the centre and people more closer to the Overton window, I think it's tricky for them. But I think the further away you get, the easier it is to start getting overwhelmed with, you know, the black pill, so to speak. It gets tough. So any time I like people want to discuss like dealing with this type of thing, like I'm super keen on all that stuff because it's just I feel like it's a bit of an empty subject a little bit to some extent.
Well, you know, it's not spoken about enough. Yeah, it isn't talked about enough. But what I would say is, woe is me. You know, imagine what it was like for me, because when I got into this stuff, it was 2002 and there was no scene at all. There was no movement at all. So yeah. And that's the case for lots of people. I mean, it's not like I'm unique here. There were loads of people who eventually found each other on something like the Telegraph blogs, where I first met Morgoth, actually, when that was like 2008 or something. And then other websites, I was on the Theodore Dalrymple forum where I first met Reactionary Expat. And then YouTube started. And, well, I mean, obviously YouTube started in 2005 or 2006. What I mean is this scene began.
Yeah, so you were talking about this.
To that, there was nowhere, really.
So you were talking about this stuff before you had your YouTube channel. I guess you would have been thinking, I didn't realize you were actually involved in an online community before then.
Yeah, this was a major part. I'll be doing a retrospective of the first 5 years of this channel in January with Reactionary Expat, where we will talk about the background to the channel that some people might not know. I think it will be fairly interesting for people. It's going to be a big video. It's going to be like a big, long conversation, like 2 or 3 hours, I think, where we talk about where it came from and what it's, how it evolved, how it started, how it went on and what it is now and what the future for it is. So I'm really looking forward to recording that. But in that, we will talk about this. But, you know, to give you a potted version now, yeah, we were on a forum and it was dedicated to the writer Theodore Dalrymple. This started in 2011. And that was my first sort of home on the internet, really, a political home on the internet. Prior to that, I'd been on the Doctor Who forum, things like that. But anyway, I mean, forums are a historical thing at this point. Back then, you would spend like a couple of a year or so on a forum, and then you'd move on and find another one. That was how people sort of existed then in the 2000s. So this was my first political home on the internet. And that was very useful, actually, for dealing with, like, sort of maturing my ideas. I think I was in my late 20s at that point, and it was a very useful thing. And as I say, I met Reactionary Expat there. It was a very, very small community, but it was very useful, very useful. And then that started to die down, and the channel, I needed a new outlet. And I was going to do a blog, but I thought, I don't want to do any more writing, because I've done so much writing on that forum. So that was why I started the channel.
Yeah, just being able to find people who you're ideologically close to can be a great thing when you're kind of an outcast like that. And I totally agree. I think the more that this grows, the more people who have these ideas, the easier it is to make the jump. The hardest ones is the first people to make the jump. The hardest jump in terms of the people who go out and really, put their flag in the ground, so to speak, before anyone else has, for some of these difficult topics. Those are the people that really should gain the most kind of admiration and respect, because they took the hardest journey. It's much easier to follow ideologically than it is to lead, I guess I'd say.
Well, yeah, it can be. I think that nowadays, I think part of the trouble is that, well, when you're young, it's much more easy to be ideologically rigid and shrill than when you're older. And so there are a lot of guys, young guys, who grow up with 4chan now, and it's all sort of, and I don't want to be disparaging, I'm glad that 4chan exists. And 8chan exists, and I'm glad that YouTube exists and all this. But I think the cost of it is that you get young guys who've never really dealt with this, like, they're not really contemplated it in depth. It's been given to them. And so they're quite blinkered, quite one-eyed about stuff, which I think is unfortunate. But that's, that's going to happen with any subculture or political fringe community. People are going to arrive with the ideas already formed. And so they just sort of adopt them. But it's a problem, but it's not a huge serious problem. It's just something that has to be dealt with.
Yeah, I totally agree. One of the things I've noticed is, because I moved from hard left to hard right, I guess most people would say, I have a means of comparison. I have a means of how other people are thinking. And I think you are right. I think if you pick up the ideas from a young age and they're all already pre-packaged, it's easier for you to be single-minded. It's harder for you to make some sense of comparison. There's some kind of limits there, certainly. It's a little bit like, you risk having this sense of people just getting on the train and just parroting, versus people who actually have at least some depth to their ideas and have thought things through. And I guess the risk is that they can become like the equivalent of SJWs in a sense, just spouting talking points without any real depth behind what they're saying. And I'm not suggesting you need to know everything about, all of history, but just being able to talk about ideas in a relatively meaningful and deep way is real key, I think, at least in some sense. Otherwise, you can just become a parrot, or you may just be a parrot.
Yeah, well, I think it's better for people's you can make an arse of yourself if you're too ideologically rigid and too simplistic, right? Because all it takes is someone else to come in and say, well, what about this situation? You hadn't thought of that, and you hadn't thought about it. So, it's important to remember, politics isn't everything in life. Ideology certainly isn't everything in life. I'm not saying that ideology is bad. I'm just saying, remain human, basically.
Yeah, certainly. There has to be some flexibility there. Like, I've had a few discussions recently where I've kind of felt like if you're too black and white in your thinking, you just can't win. You can't get anywhere. You have to be willing to compromise really on everything in a sense, because you're never going to meet anybody who's ideologically the same as you to in absolute and all details. So it just becomes a sense of compromise. And the broader, the more you zoom out and the broader topics you're dealing with, the more you're forced to compromise, because the bigger the numbers you're dealing with in terms of how many people are required to compromise. With yourself as an individual, you don't have to compromise, you know, on your own life and what you choose to do day to day. This is kind of an interesting idea, really, this idea of essentially the collective force compromise, and you can't really get around that. Once you acknowledge that, you're going to start making some different types of decisions and being a bit more flexible in your ideas.
Yeah, for sure. Okay, so, and the other thing is that I think that's good for mental health as well, because it means that you don't box yourself into an impossible goal, a worldview that actually alienates you from other people. I mean, and I'm not saying that you should be a cuck. I'm just saying, don't be so locked in the ideology that you can't think outside of it. And because I always think it's important to remember that politics isn't everything in life. And other people, I was saying this with one of the other hangouts, maybe last night, that you should be able to talk to anyone. That's the ideal, to be able to just get along with people. And I think there is a danger. And you see it with lefties. You see it with SJWs. They cannot talk to anyone who doesn't agree with them, because they're obsessed with spreading the ideology. And anyone who doesn't just take it on board or agree with it or go along with it is like an obstacle that they hadn't foreseen, and they don't know how to respond. And of course, if you are shaped in the modern university environment, then it's understandable why you would become like that. But I don't think it's good for anyone. And I don't think it's good for us either. I also don't think that it actually helps us to spread our ideas or to convince people of our ideas, because, well, what are you? You're a Dalek. You're just spouting buzzwords. That clearly is not a good thing. It doesn't look like somebody who's sane and balanced and reliable, whose thinking can be relied upon. So, all right, let's move on from that. I think we've made the point. So what would be another one? Democracy, and once natives are a minority. So let's talk about the social democracy. What would you say that people mean by the term social democracy? Because that seems to be the paradigm that we're living under, or have been living under, in the last few decades. So let's go into that just now and talk about what it is and what it requires. Let's go for that. What is social democracy?
I guess I'd say I'm not sure. I've never really looked up the definition of those two words put together. So you can kind of, maybe you can, that sounds really weak, maybe you can help me out.
Well, it's the term that's used to describe, for example, Sweden or Germany or Britain today, etc., modern Western European countries. And it seems to be a country that has decided that, historical history doesn't really matter. Actually, it's as broad as that. And here we are, we've got consumerism, we've got industry, we've got technology, we've got infrastructure, we've got democracy. And so this is a system that is kind of, decoupled from history. And so anyone can take part in it. And that means that it's all just negotiation and voting. And when you vote, that is safe and reliable, because it's a majority result, and everyone will go along with what the majority decide. And what the majority decide will be the right thing, by and large. That's the thinking here. I think that that's simply not true. What the majority decide in a democratic vote might well not be the right thing. With Brexit, I think it was, but that's a... could be anything. It could be any topic, any issue. So I don't really trust democracy, but I certainly don't trust a democracy that is, deracinated from history and identity, because then basically it's a free-for-all, and it really is just two wolves and a sheep voting on what to have for dinner. That's the trouble. And that's exactly what we've done now. We're importing more and more people who are not ancestrally, historically, or even culturally connected to our societies. But the thing is, I mean, it's the end of history thing. You know, after World War II and after the Cold War, which feels kind of like a big delaying tactic after World War II. It's like, didn't really change much. It was just sort of freezing things, sort of stifling things. But anyway, after the Cold War, there was this assumption that, okay, now we know what to do. Now we know how to live. And you know, the result or the definition of how to live was a social democracy. And it relies upon so much comfort and technological groundwork and background, so much technological fabric, that it is actually very, very fragile. But as long as the resources keep coming in, as long as the transportation channels keep operating, as long as the lights stay on, and as long as the food is on the shelves at the supermarket, the shopping mall, it can be sustained. The trouble is that while that's going on, you're importing people who are going to eventually want more than this. I mean, in our case, the whites might not want more than that. They might be completely doped up on, you know, NPC thinking. So they're fine. But meantime, their societies are importing millions of, let's not name names, but peoples who are going to want something more existentially meaty than this, than a sort of atheist shopping mall with, you know, cultures just on the shelf, you know, everything's meaningless. No, people want meaning. And as I say, I think that this is the trouble with social democracy. It sort of invites catastrophe. It invites us to indeed pile up our own funeral pyre. And I think that's exactly what we have done.
Yeah, well, I think that we didn't realize that we were basically kind of riding on the coattails of all of the success that Europe had had, despite the world wars. Essentially, we were building at the top of a giant structure, I guess you'd say, at least in terms of everything that came before, both the technology and the culture and the society, all that stuff was built up over a very long period. And we went forward with this sense of that doesn't really matter. We didn't realize that foundation basically was 90% of why life was so easy. And basically a society has to kind of be connected to something. Something has to have a root to it, something deeper than just ideas, in all honesty. Like one of the problems I've had with civic nationalism is just this sense of ideas aren't enough. And I think one of the problems America's facing at the minute is that they've got a country built on ideas to some degree, whereas Europe doesn't have that so much. We did have a peoples originally, you know.
But it's funny how we've been altered. Like our culture, I just want to point this out. It's funny how our culture has been altered to be in alignment with the American culture, so that now our societies are just about ideas as well. So everywhere is like America. And then they start retroactively just revising the history and saying that, but Britain is a nation of immigrants and no one really belongs here. So, you know, what are you mourning about?
Yeah, I mean, if you zoom out far enough, it's like they kind of have a point in one sense, but they don't in the sense of, you know, the people in Europe, natives, I would call them, I think, what, 10,000 years, quite a long time they were established here. So I wouldn't call them immigrants. But in regards to democracy, my sense is that ultimately, I mean, people don't believe that the majority is right. If 51% of the people vote to kill the other 49%, most people would agree it's not the right decision. So it's a tricky one because people take it for granted just that it's a good thing. It's almost become like it's one of those things that people just say, our democracy, our wonderful democracy, or, you know, we just like we all want equality, all this stuff. People just reel it off. There's no, like we were talking about earlier, it's such a shallow thing. There's nothing really beneath that in terms of what they're saying. And if you actually pick at the idea of, you know, basically getting into a group and making decisions, the democratic answer is not necessarily going to be the right one. I mean, and that's a difficult thing to grapple with when, you know, when your culture is essentially has been endorsing this as like for many, many years. The reason democracy worked in many ways is because we had a kind of a united culture. We had a group of people who, broadly speaking, had a history. We had common values and ideas. Now, you could argue whether or not this was based in genetics or just, you know, or not. But the reality is that we took that for granted and we didn't realize the value in it. And now, as we're importing cultures that aren't the same as ours, we're going to have to learn, or we're going to be forced to learn, that that's going to have severe consequences for democracy. I guess you could say democracy is a little bit like it's a veneer, in a sense that it kind of hides. It kind of hides this sense of, you can easily take for granted that all of this other stuff bubbling up underneath the surface, like I was just saying, like the fact that you've got a group that have a shared history and a shared kind of kinship, all of that stuff matters if you want democracy to be successful, I guess is what I'm saying. And without that, with multiculturalism, with globalism, it's basically going to put democracy to the ultimate test. And, you know, people are talking about this, you know, once you're a minority, we're seeing it in South Africa, you know, what power do the Boer have to make any real change in their society? That's the future that we face in Europe. If native birth rates continue to be below replacement and everyone else is breeding like rabbits, like that's the dark future in the longer term. And so it's funny.
Well, this is a point that I've made. Sorry, you go.
Well, it's funny because, you know, everyone's like going bonkers about Brexit in the UK at the minute. But once you start getting into this type of subject, it all feels very trivial all of a sudden. Carry on.
Well, this is a point that I've made, that social democracy, because it assumes that everyone is equal and that it's irrational and stupid to think that people are not all equal. Because of that, social democracy doesn't give you any means at all, doesn't give you any grounds upon which to object to your people being replaced by another people, because all peoples are the same anyway. So there it is. But the trouble is that those other peoples might well think that they're different from you and that you're different from them. And they might well think that, well, once we get into power, once we are demographically dominant, we're going to make life hell for you. Now that is, some people would say that's fear mongering. I might be wrong. Maybe everything will be fine. But I don't. I think the lessons of history show that no, we're not going to be fine. Basically, we are uniquely altruistic here. That seems to be the lesson, because everyone else is more racist than whites. Basically, you can see that in study after survey after survey, and. So why would they be different just because they happen to be living in Europe or North America, whatever? Those instincts are probably going to resurge, especially because they will historically have been minorities in these countries. So they'll have a lot of resentment built up, and especially because they are being encouraged to have resentment towards us now while they are minorities. So once they are in control, what are they going to do? First of all, are they going to be nice to us? I don't think so. And second, are they going to maintain our standards of living? I don't think so. And thirdly, are they going to keep our countries on the historical trend that they've been on for, you know, centuries and centuries? I don't see any reason why they would. So basically, without the same people being dominant in a country, it is going to change, and it might not be nice at all for the people who were once dominant. But the point is, with social democracy, These are all realities, I think, that I've just described. But social democracy refuses to recognize them even as possibilities because it insists that all people are the same and that all it takes to get over these silly tribal differences that people insist on believing in, all it takes is indoctrination at the education, at the infant level, at the school level, to make them realize that, of course, everyone's the same, really. So they don't need to care about this identity thing. Well, but okay, but what happens when we are no longer in charge of the schools and other people are who do believe in identity? I mean, it doesn't even work now. It doesn't even work now when we're in charge of the schools and we're telling them that identity doesn't matter because they still grow up to have these tribal feelings. And also, another problem on top of this is that we don't any longer tell them that identity doesn't matter. We tell that to ourselves. We tell that to the white kids at schools. But meantime, we're telling the children of color, the pupils of color, that they absolutely should care about their identity, their racial identity, and so on. So this is an interesting thing about social democracy. It ends with self-destruction. It ends with that's what we're doing right now. Even while we tell ourselves that racial identity doesn't matter, we're telling the newcomers to care about their identity and to resent us on a racial basis. So it's like we're destroying ourselves while telling ourselves that the means we're using to destroy ourselves aren't even real, racial identity.
Yeah, it's a mad, mad kind of contradiction. You see these, magazines like these kind of black fashion magazines and things, and you kind of think of what would the equivalent be if it was like called white, white X or something, whatever the topic would be, the kind of the social fallout of something like that. What you're saying was resonating me in various ways. With the whites in South Africa, they are a minority in that country. That gives you a blueprint about how a white minority is treated. They certainly aren't. The reverse isn't true. Once whites are a minority, it appears that they don't get the same kind of leg up or help that we afford minorities today. The assumption that we're all equal and the same is really the backbone of it all, because ultimately it's kind of easy to figure out that this is going to be an issue, in the sense that, if you look at, I did a video on this where you just look at all the Islamic countries in the world is in majority Muslim, the types of laws that they have and all this stuff. I mean, you can basically copy and paste that over to some degree. And yeah, sure, ideas may kind of nudge peoples in certain directions to some degree, but you have to account for the basic instincts that are there. And my belief, at least, is that the basic instincts between cultures and between peoples vary. I don't think, and you were saying about the pathological altruism is the one that people kind of put on whites. And I totally agree. I think that there's certain traits that some people have, whether they're cultural or biological. We don't necessarily need to get into that. But they have difference that has huge consequences once you start zooming out and talking about numbers, especially when you're under democracy, which is essentially mob rule when it comes down to it to some degree. So it gets tricky, because like you say, I mean, how do you bring these topics into the mainstream? You certainly can't do it quickly. It's going to be drip drip, and people are going to have to see consequences really before they make this kind of leap, as in the mainstream people, I guess.
Well, there you go. At that point you get to you're asking, what can we do? And I do think that there are things that we can do. I think there are things we can all do. I don't think it's... I'm not black-pilled, really, at least not at Christmas. I'm trying to... I'm making an effort to be more optimistic. But in general, I'm not really black-pilled. I do think that we will work this out. But the crucial part of it, and this is something that we need to get across to the lefties and the centrists, the crucial part of it is identity, because if you've not got something to protect, then you're not going to put in the work to protect it. If you don't care about this thing, then why would you do anything to look after it? But without that thing, without identity, everything else isn't really worth caring about, because in the end, nobody gives a fuck about principles. Are a luxury. They're not the objects of survival. Identity is, you know, your group, your ethnic group, your people is something that is worth fighting and living and dying for. It has been historically for people all, you know, forever. So I don't think that, I think that is the thing we've got to get across to people, that you are off a story, as I've said. That's one way that I articulated it a few years ago. You are off a story. It has been going for centuries, millennia, and it does need your help, because you know, you have a part to play here. It might not be a huge, fancy, glamorous part, but it's a part anyway, and it is something that we can all do and should all do, because it's either that or despair. You know, it's either that or you just sort of collapse in a heap and assume that we're all going to fail and there's no point. You know, even if we do fail, I think that we should fail. We should go down fighting. That's the crucial thing. I mean, and I know that's easier said than done, but, you know, sorry, you go.
Yeah, at least die, what is it they say, die by your shield? Is that what they say? That's saying, you know, at least die, kind of go down fighting. Yeah, I mean, this is great what you're saying. And I think people want to be a link in the chain rather than the end of the chain. And I think that's really what we're kind of tugging at a little bit. My sense is that people really do want to be part of a greater whole in this sense. And currently, as individuals in this society, we've not really been educated into that. We've kind of had to find that ourselves, like people like you and myself and others. But other people don't have any of that, because they've kind of still got the blinkers on, so to speak. And in terms of, you know, why, what is this urge to, you know, to be part of something and to have a shared a group and a tribe, so to speak? My sense is as well is that to a large degree, life is essentially a contest. And one of the tough things that we're going to be grappling with as time moves on is that, as difficult it is as it is to accept, there are going to be winners and losers in life. And basically, that is the story of nature. It's the story of everything. And currently, the West is absolutely not able to grapple with this. We can't accept that the third world is never going to develop. No matter how much money we put into it, it's never going to develop. And all these types of things, because that's the way those people are. You know, when Japan was bombed back into the Stone Age during the Second World War, I might be being a bit hyperbolic there, but they rebuilt their society very quick. Those people have something that was theirs, and they built it. Like, you can't just just to finish off my point, what was I going to say? If we don't realize that life is in some sense these groups of tribes basically in kind of an eternal conflict to some degree, not necessarily violent conflicts, but it can be ideological conflict. Just they're tribes that are essentially again working against each other to one degree or another. If you don't kind of get involved in that and compete, basically you're going to die out like the Neanderthals. So that's really will be the ultimate choice, really, is are you going to kind of compete like every other group does and like every other animal species ever has, or are you going to just give up?
There's that, but there's also, you see, I think it's important. What you just said is absolutely true, and I agree with it, and I accept it. But I think there's another way to look at it, which is more positive, more white-pilled, if you like. You asked why do people care about being something, about being part of something greater than themselves. And part of it is survival. And someone in the chat said that the collective is the soil that the individual grows out of. That's one way to look at it. So part of it is survival. But another reason why you want to be part of something greater than yourself is, first of all, when I think of the Germans, I gave a speech in Berlin a few months ago, which goes into this. I haven't uploaded it yet. That'll be going up in January. The Germans are obsessed with sacrifice and duty and service and so on, because that's how they define themselves. The individual defines himself by giving of himself to the greater good. Now, in Britain, I don't think we have quite that same drive, but it's there. But another part of another sort of the way that it manifests in us, group identity, ethnic identity, national identity, I think it's more, and this also applies to the Germans and to other peoples as well, but I think this is relevant to the Brits. I think that we see Britain as a story and as the setting for our lives. And it's the landscape, it's the village where all these things have happened, a million things that any one of us will witness in his lifetime, and a billion further things that we will not witness, but we can guess at them, and at the people who lived through those stories. And this is what it ultimately is. This is what it amounts to. It's something precious. It's something unique. It's something that informs and shapes each one of us. Why would you not want to look after that? And how insane would you have to be to not care about that? I think it's really as simple as that. I mean, I could probably go on, but I think I've made the point already, so there's no need to elaborate. This is the story of which you're a part. This thing is the setting for your existence to take place in. So, I just think it's natural and inevitable that you should look after that thing and that you should care enough about it to look after it. So you don't even need to intellectualize it any further than that. And you don't need to bring in issues of survival. This is a matter of meaning. Survival is one thing, meaning is another. And, the animal issue of survival is important, but so is the human issue of meaning and sanctity. And I think that these are two different ways that you can look at it, which are equally valid and equally important. So, that's what I would say about this. So we are human beings, and we define ourselves partly through the soil from which each of us grew. So yeah. We should look after that.
I understand what you're saying. My sense when I was talking about that was this sense of as we face tougher and tougher times. My sense is that there's a balance between morality and survival, I guess you'd say, and that the tougher this gets in terms of the demographics and the long term decline, so to speak, the more that the balance is going to shift away from morality towards survival to some extent. And I think these two things kind of have a tension between them in terms of there's always a pull one way or the other, and the more society is thriving, the more ideas and morality can come to the forefront. The more society is struggling, the more that survival starts to have more weight in terms of it just has more weight once the society starts to decline or struggle. So I guess I'm kind of talking about the stuff I was just saying in regards to that, like in the tough future that we were talking about, that may be ahead, survival is going to play a bigger role, I guess, is all I'm saying. But yeah, sure. I mean, I totally agree. Being that link in the chain and having a sense of just being part of something is important. I mean, my sense is that's one of the big reasons why we have a lot of problems with people, you know, seriously depressed and things, is because they're not really part of anything. So yeah, anyway, that's what all I'd say on that, really, in response.
Yeah, I understand what you're saying. I'm not trying to devalue it. I understand that survival is absolutely important. I'm just saying that, and of course I agree, it's going to become a very pertinent issue to a lot of people in this century. But I would say also just don't forget why we're surviving, basically. It's not just an animal impulse. It's because we are something special. So, okay, let's leave it at that. So, any final things you'd like to say? Europe is falling.
Not so much. No. Thank you very much for having me on, and I really think that this, in particular, this event each year is a very good idea to bring different types of people in the right together. And I think it's a hell of a lot of work for you. So kind of just give you a big kind of thumbs up there and a thank you.
Oh, thank you for saying that. I appreciate that, because it really was a lot of work to arrange this, particularly this year. So yeah, I appreciate that. Okay, so this is Europe is Falling. Thank you for taking part in Millennial. I hope you get some new subscribers from this. And okay, I will be back in, let me see, about 40 minutes with, who is it next? Identity Australia. So, okay, I'll see you then. In the meantime, go and subscribe to Europe is Falling, and I will see you later.